রবি গৌড়চন রায়, রাধিকায় তদালয়ে কৃষ্ণায় কৃষ্ণ ভক্তায় তদ ভক্তায় নমো নমঃ। সো প্রণাম টু অল অফ ইউ। Greetings from Sri Ananda Ashram, and welcome to our weekly satsang Q&A Ishtagosti. However you may like to call it, gathering, tribe gathering, village setting, trying to basically continue to not only to heal, to grow, to rediscover, explore the roots on the tapestry of reality together. So thank you for your presence today. I'm seeing a few raised hands already. Those who may have anything you may like to share today that has been burning your gut throughout the last week, or your brain, or your heart, or not burning it, but somehow making it vibrate in a necessary way to share. Community and communion, you're more than invited to raise your digital hand in this case, and eventually we'll try to address it. So far I'm seeing four raised hands, so we'll start there. First with, it says Anuradha and Sam, but I assume it's Sam because Anuradha disappeared from the camera, so
he's disappeared.
Your turn, Sam.
Okay. First of all, it's lovely to see you again, Maharaj, and everybody. My question is related to a statement from Krishna book where Srila Prabhupada quotes the politician Janaka Pandit. So he says, the great politician Janakya Pandit said, never put your trust in a diplomat or in a woman. Those who are addicted to unrestricted sense gratification can never be truthful, nor can they be trusted with any faith. And I was just curious, what is the meaning of
What is
that?
the what, sorry?
What is the meaning? What does that statement mean? Because it's in the chapter of the advent of Lord Krishna. So I was wondering, in what way is that relevant? Like, what does it mean? That's what I mean. Yeah.
Well, of course, to know the meaning of the context, I will have to get the whole, because that's quoted by Prabhupada. This, of course, Janakya Pandit is not in the Bhagavatam. So Prabhupada is quoting that in the midst of whatever narrative is taking place. So I don't know what's the narrative that is taking place. I mean, you said what's the chapter, but what has been, he has been commenting or saying before and after, we will need to go through the text itself. And I don't want now to make it a half an hour reading.
I have that.
Yeah, but again, I don't
What
want to
shall I
make it like
show? Okay, yeah.
a long, tedious reading. Like, you have been reading it, so there is no hint for you. I mean, I'll go to the Chanakya Pandit's words, but your part of your question is why this is being brought up in that chapter of the advent of Krishna. So you have been reading that section, it seems to me. So there is anything that makes you think that maybe this was brought because of this particular other topic said before?
The topic that's brought before is related to when Vasudev returns home with his firstborn child, because he was with from having went to Kamsa, but he can't trust Kamsa because Kamsa was uncontrolled. So I think Prabhupada's
Okay.
using that
Yeah.
in
So
relationship to Kamsa's being untrustworthy.
because Chanakya Pandit is saying, apart from woman, he's speaking about politician.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's interesting, right? Because Srila Prabhupada is introducing Chanakya Pandit as a politician. And then Chanakya Pandit's quote say, never trust a politician. There is something there, right? With all respect to Chanakya Pandit, but you have to play out the implications of all that. So, first of all, right, a few things apart from what I just said, which is a point I will say. Again, if a politician tells you never trust a politician, okay, what to do about it? Shall I trust him or not? Because, but Chanakya Pandit, I know that Prabhupada at times quoted Chanakya Pandit. Chanakya Pandit is not the same as quoting Rupa Goswami, or as quoting Srimad Bhagavatam, or as quoting Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur, or whatever. No, Chanakya Pandit was a politician. So sometimes, whatever Prabhupada or someone else, mostly Prabhupada, I can recall of him quoting Chanakya Pandit at times, he may be quoting it to make a particular point, but in a very relative realm, so to say. So Chanakya Pandit is not our to-go place to establish Gaudiya Vaishnava Siddhanta, right? Again, Prabhupada introduced him as a politician, whether it's great politician or not, but politician is not the same as sadhu, pure devotee, or whatever. And again, on top of that, then comes the line, do not trust a politician. So that on one side, right? Because sometimes devotees will, and this is connected to what we'll be studying in a few days when we start studying the Bhagavatam, that if we don't develop a discernment as to what holds absolute truth and what's more of a relative content, we will just pick anything and everything and just create our own philosophy, basically, and justify anything based on this say that and that say that. So Chanakya Pandit say many things. Many of them are considerably misogynistic. So I do not agree with any of those, which doesn't mean that he may not have any good points to make in other realms, which is another thing, right? Someone may be carrying a cultural baggage of their time in, let's say, I'll go in a minute to the section on woman, because I imagine for most of you that just heard the question, the main point is why he's saying that about woman. Why is he saying that about woman? There are two different ways of seeing it. Of course, one could be, okay, he's not speaking from an absolute platform of an enlightened sage. He's speaking as a politician with probably some cultural prejudice of the time, and he may be seeing woman as inferior. That's not true. I mean, I do not agree with that. Some other people will agree with that, of course. As we know in this current day conversation, woman and qualification of woman for being gurus or for being anything. And some people thinking women are inferior in terms of being born in a woman's body, and therefore that disqualifies them for certain services, for certain roles in bhakti, which, as we say many times, and we may need to say it many more times, is sheer absurdity, because that contradicts the core basic ABC lesson of bhakti, which is bhakti is above karma. So if you have a woman's body or a man's body, by the way, it's because of karma. So if your karmic momentum disqualifies you from bhakti, and no matter how much bhakti you can have, sorry, your karmic momentum is more than that. You are putting karma above bhakti, and that's totally against a very basic understanding of what bhakti is. Anya-vilasita-shunyam jnana-karma-adhyana-vritam, right? Rupa Goswami defines bhakti as bhakti, real bhakti, in its conception, what to speak, in its practice, in its fruit, in its conception, bhakti is above jnana and karma. So if you put karma above bhakti, then you are getting bhakti wrong. So maybe Chanakya Pandit got bhakti wrong because how much of a bhakta he was, I don't know. Again, he was mostly known as a politician. So he may have some insights and knowledge or in terms of politics and how to deal with certain social dynamics and so on. Now, another way of understanding that, because I cannot tell you which was Chanakya Pandit's intention in saying what he said. I'm not inside his heart. Another way of taking it, because you will find that not only in Chanakya Pandit, but in other parts of scripture, this type of like warning, right? Do not trust this. Do not associate with this. And sometimes women are included in that combo. So that means, and unfortunately, these type of sections have been taken as women are dangerous. So men have to be careful because women are dangerous. So if a woman is coming, watch out, because the personification of temptation is knocking your door. Again, I'm being sarcastic here. I hope you get it. The point is that most of these statements are written by men. So I can understand that a man may say, for me, a woman is dangerous, but not because the women are dangerous, but because men are dangerous. Men cannot control themselves in proximity to a woman. But unfortunately, sometimes, I mean, if you pay attention to the list of sexual abuse in history, it's not that women are leading the list, so to say. Not to say that, again, just by being a woman, you're automatically saintly and innocent of anything. No, we are not going there either, but let's be honest with statistics. So mostly these type of things are more like preventive in terms of a man may be tempted by woman in an improper way, and for that not to happen, for a man not to end up exploiting woman, some of those warnings are there, but sometimes all that is read as women are bad, women are temptation, women are of the devil, whatever. So men, watch out. But again, you could take that same statement, which generally are spoken by men and therefore are focused on women, and you can turn it the other way around, and you could say the same in the other direction. a woman may be tempted if it's the word, or entangled for the wrong reasons with the man in a way that ends up being harming for the lady or for the man, for both. So, and sometimes you will find throughout the Bible, you'll find some stories where women misbehave and stories of men who misbehave. So basically the idea is both women and men are men. In potential are a mess, and in potential they can be incredibly beautiful. Both potentials are there for both, right? So it's not here like women are intrinsically bad. There is something in their constitution that makes them worse than men, nor the other way around either. Again, let's not get caught in this over-identification and over-stigmatizing one or the other, men or women are better or worse. Because if whatever case we go in those directions, we're still playing the dualistic game. We are reinforcing this toxic sense of separation rather than trying to bring wholeness, harmony, and seeing each other as one in an essential way, right? So yeah, according to the context, going back to your question, Sam, of course, the narrative is about Vasudev going to Mathura, meeting with Kamsa, and Kamsa being a politician, and we know Kamsa was not precisely the coolest kid on the block, so to say. He was quite crooked and he wanted basically to kill Krishna, let's put it simply. No, he wanted to see God dead, let's put it that way. And he was a politician, and yeah, let's pay attention to many politicians, even at that time, what to speak now. They are not most of them, well, not all of them, but most of them are not the most trustworthy entities on planet Earth, let's put it that way. So, in the context of that narrative, Prabhupada is bringing Chanakya Pandit to say, never trust a politician. Again, by the way, said by a politician. I can appreciate that honesty. Like, okay, I'm a politician, and I can tell you, never trust a politician. Okay, thank you. Now, when you say about the woman, why you mentioned that about the woman again, and I try to unpack that in the way I did, because if we interpret that statement in any other way, it becomes a deviation from our understanding as bhaktas. What's a woman? What's a man? Who we are ultimately beyond those designations. So I don't know if that helps some.
Oh, very much, Maharaj. Very much. That really helps to flesh out that section
Yeah.
so much more. Thank you so much, Maharaj.
Yeah, and again, thank you. Thank you for the question. One more thing that comes to my mind is, of course, because the statement of Chanakya Pandit is quite conclusive, right? Never trust a politician, never trust a woman. So it's quite like absolutistic, conclusive, like all women are not to be trusted. All politicians are never to be trusted. And it's not the way, it's not the case. Even if we will say, okay, there are some women that may not be trustworthy, there are some men which may be not be trustworthy, there are some politics, or there even may be the majority, hypothetically, still that doesn't mean that you have to apply that law universally. So it's more like a way of speaking strongly with absolutistic terms to give some warning, no? Like I don't know. Again, like if someone goes through some particular traumatic situation with a politician, let's say, whatever, and you are totally burnt out or traumatized or damaged, and the other person say, never trust a politician. So that doesn't mean that all politicians are bad people. It's just that it's a way of saying that in a particular context to a particular people to create a particular, oh, probably it's not that no politician is trustworthy, but probably is that most politicians are not trustworthy because the very nature of politics is thinking in terms of us and them and creating parties and there is divisiveness and therefore that in general lends itself to some form of compromising one's integrity. So all that said, watch out in that direction, something like that, which may translate in a certain culture, in a certain time, where a certain time of talking, never do it. Never trust that. So in the same way, one could say, I don't know, never trust a woman. That doesn't mean, again, all women are not trustworthy. It's just probably in most cases, a man may not be able to fully relate to a woman in a healthy place. So you have just to apply a dose of, what's this word? A dose of, help me. Yeah, care. There was another word. It's not coming, right? But discretion,
Caution.
yeah. Discretion, care, discernment, but mostly from your side, not so much creating a neurosis in terms of universal conspiracy. I have to mistrust everyone, right? I cannot trust them. I cannot, because you are creating a regime of fear in that case. Never trust them, never trust them, never trust them. While we are trying to promote a culture of love and faith and trust, not to be naive, again, we have to apply, have criterion. But yeah, we have to be careful with all those sentences that start with never, always. Like a friend of mine will tell me, the always only belong to the supreme. No. Who are we to say never do that or I will never do that? I will always be like this. Who knows? Let's see. Right. So yeah, we have to take some of these statements as they will say in English. What is with a pinch of salt? Yeah. So do not put them on the same place of the scale of other more absolute applicable place and circumstance statements like God loves you unconditionally, you're eternal, and so on and so forth. That's always true, no matter what. But this never trust this or that, that's quite relative. So, yeah, there is place for relative statements, but we should put them in their proper department, so to say. Thank you. Okay. Oh, we have something called breakout rooms. I forgot. do you feel like going there or not? I'm up to you guys. Rasangi doesn't want to go to breakout rooms.
Let's
Patrick
wait
doesn't
one
want.
more. We're
What?
gonna. I think we
What?
should just wait one more.
Okay, one
That
more.
I just think.
Then Sveta Devradika, welcome.
Pranam, Maharaj. So, talking about women, I'm reading this like really beautiful book called On Saint Clare of Assisi, Heartful of Love by Ilia Delio. Gifted by dear Manjuali, thank you. And it's so amazing. But yeah, like one of the, it seems like there's a huge emphasis on like being poor, like poverty of human and God, in a sense that she talks about how like like getting rid of our possessions, help us like connect with God. Even though like I mean I heard you say recently somewhere maybe in one of the podcasts about getting rid of possessions is not necessarily material, it is about like emptying ourselves. And I mean Ilia Delio also talks about it quite a bit actually, that it is not just material poverty but also like spiritual. But it also seems like there is this idea of like being dependent on others, like if you're materially poor, I guess like it helps even like materially, spiritually, everything that causes that dependency, which like helps us see the which reveals the goodness of God in others when we depend. So I was thinking that there's a tendency that like when we depend on others, there's a tendency to feel guilty or something like that, that we are causing inconvenience to others. And in some cases that can be true. It could be an inconvenience. But also there is this aspect of like being vulnerable and like that allowing a deeper connection and like deeper relationship and all of that. So yeah, I mean, I'm just trying to understand, like, like really want to hear from you. What do you, what are your thoughts about, like, being dependent? Like, is there are there conditions and like, how does it really look, like being dependent on each other, like that thought. I was also thinking, like in your case, like being a sannyasi, you don't have your own possessions as much like that, and I don't know how you feel, like what, your like thoughts and yeah, views.
Thank you. Okay, where to begin? So we are, your question is, of course, let's begin by the context from the question where the question arises, which is the reading of the life of Saint Clare of Assisi. And as some of you us know, of course, both hers and her order and Saint Francis' order emphasize a lot the notion of poverty, and they played out that in practice to very extreme degrees, to which even I will say nowadays, almost none of the followers are doing that in that way, to that degree of extremity. And even there are many who will not criticize that, but will say, okay, maybe that was a little bit overtly romanticized idea of embracing poverty in ways that were not so practical, or were not so even healthy for their bodies, or it was a little bit renunciation oriented, so to say, right? More like, and again, there are different opinions, and let's make it clear, we are talking about Saint Clare of Assisi. She follows a certain way of practicing and living. That doesn't mean that that's Gaudiya Vaishnavism, right? So when living about the life of someone like her, it doesn't mean that, oh, how I'm supposed to live my life like her? Who said that you are supposed to live your life like her? How I'm supposed to align with the way she practices poverty? Who say we are supposed to do that? Even in our own tradition, we have very extreme examples of similar things, taking poverty literally to not owning a penny, right? Like recently I was reading the life of Tinkadi Baba, who he's Kishori Kishorananda Baba, the guru of Vinod Bihari Das Babaji. Some of you may know about him more. So anyhow, he was Babaji, very renowned, very poor, very avadut-like. And many stories similar to him, to Jagannath Das Babaji and other personalities like them. They will receive, sometimes someone will bring them like a coin, right? Like give a donation of a coin, and they will just like, after a few minutes, feel so much weight. The coin is burning, and they run back and give the coin back to the person. It's like, ooh, I couldn't handle that. It's too much. What do you do with that? So again, that doesn't mean that, oh, you all guys have a bank account. You are so falling and attached, and you should be like, I mean, we shouldn't go to these comparison games, right? Like Madhavendra Puri doing his Ajagata Britti, which was, he wouldn't even go for begging. He would just lay on the ground, and if Krishna wanted him to eat, he will need to make some arrangement for someone to take him some food, if not, he's fasting. Again, that's his particular example and inspiration and way of embodying a certain principle, but that pr the principle may be the same for all of us, but how it's embodied may differ according to our nature, not necessarily even only according to our level of advancement. Okay? So for example, going back to Saint Francis and their poverty thing, actually the poverty was not so much, and I've talked about this considerably with Father Richard Rohr. It was not so much about not having things, but not owning things. And owning is not literally even in terms of a legal document and their signature, but not having a sense of ownership. The literal expression in Latin is sine proprio. And proprio means in Latin, like in Spanish, like own, one's own. And sine is like sin. Not sin, not like sin in English, but sin in Spanish, which means without, like sincera. So sine proprio means without a sense that something is mine. And we will call in our tradition ahammameti, right? I, me, mine. I'm deriving my sense of I based on what I think it's mine. So it's, we have that teaching also in our own way. Don't create, don't build a sense of identity based on what you think you own. Because you don't know, you don't own anything. Yeah, things may be under your name, a house, a car, stuff, health insurance, but from the bigger picture, the real question is not what does belong to me, but whom do I belong? In the beginning, we may think more in terms of what does belong to me. We try to acquire property, acquire things that we think are mine, because we feel my sense of I is expanding out of that. Because we have a very poor sense of I in the beginning, quote unquote, in a primitive unfolding of our consciousness. We just need to have more stuff to feel that we are more. And of course, that's insatiable, as you know. No matter how much you have, you never feel, oh, now I'm full. Now I'm fooling myself. I've attained self-realization through excessive ownership. You never find one single case in the history of humanity. You will find many cases of them trying the best they can and getting that rooftop frustration of this is not going anywhere. The more I have, the more miserable I feel. Which doesn't mean you don't ha burn your house, throw your car out of the window. It means don't base your sense of I on an illusory sense of ownership. Sine proprio again. Sine proprio means basically that is without anything of one's own. That's why sometimes traditionally Vaishnavas will speak in terms of under the care of, right? You have a book or something, this under the care of. Of course, sometimes it can become just a quote and a form of repression or whatever, but there is a truth in that. I'm not owning that, but something's coming to me. Okay, I'm under the care of. It's a service. Even if I have a family, it's not my wife, my children, in the hard sense of the my. That they become objects, basically. You objectify people to develop your identity and they become your property. So I do not own them. They may be under my care, and even this under my care is I'm in service of them. And the care is mutual. Again, it's not like I care for you and you are being cared by me. It's one way street. No, we take care of each other in different ways. So that's very different to ascribing proprietorship and ownership. Because again, ultimately the real question is not what does belong to me, but whom do I belong? So as I like to say, in two powerful phrases, at least for me, you own nothing, you belong to everything. You own nothing, but the good news are, don't die of a heart attack yet. You belong to everything. Not so much everything belongs to me. That's madness. You cannot even try to do that. If you try, you go crazy. But you belong to everything. Well, I'm part of something bigger. I belong to everything. That's the actual point. And that's the proper orientation. From that, everything follows. So the notion of poverty of Franciscans, it's a way of speaking about emptying yourself, emptying from all false content, from all false designations, from all false from upadis, nirupadi. You have to become a nirupadi Vaishnav. Nirupadi means, again, I'm free, or I mean, it's a work in progress, but getting free from all these necessities of constructing an identity apart from who I am, actually, and all that I can be in who I am. So a word that we use in Sanskrit for this is akinchana. Tvam akinchana gocharam janmaishvarya shrita srivir edamanam adampumam naibarhatya vidhatum bai tvam akinchana gocharam. Kunti Devi prays. She says those, like giving a general example again, not to absolutize this, but janma, aishvarya, shruta, srivir, those who have high birth, opulence, richness, knowledge, beauty, most of them derive their sense of, I mean, she's not saying that directly, but I'm trying to play out the implications of that. Most people who have that, they become identified with that and they derive their sense of identity from that. Position, fame, power, influence, physical beauty, charisma, followers. Therefore, they cannot address you with a sincere heart, Kunti Devi is saying, because all the things are getting in the way. They are not willing to be disarmed by you, Kunti is saying. Tvam akinchana gocharam. You can only be approached by, Prabhupada will translate akinchana, they're like those who are materially exhausted. That's an interesting way of putting it, like those who have tried to accumulate and they became exhausted at one point. Oh my gosh, I cannot derive a proper sense of identity through property, fame, position, ownership. I'm exhausted. Okay, great. You reach a good point. You are corroborating the limitations of all that. You have emptied yourself of all those false hopes that the false designations bring. And now you can be more realistic about who you are. What's your prospect? So that's one way of speaking about this also, right? About poverty. Saint Francis will speak about poverty. We can even make connections, interfaith connection with similar terminology. I speak about that in radical personalism. Saint Francis' poverty, somehow connected to Jesus going to the desert. Again, it's a place of emptiness, to empty yourself. Buddhists will speak about sunya, the void. We'll say akinchana. And akinchana, interestingly, means someone who has no possessions, akinchana, without possessions, or again, without a sense of possessiveness. Though, interestingly, that's another conversation, right? But one of the main qualities of prem, Rupa Goswami says, is mamatva, or possessiveness. But possessiveness toward Krishna, right? Which is very different. You have centered your sense of possessiveness. Instead of thinking in terms of I, me, mine, according to what I think I have and what I think I am, with Krishna, I can have a proper sense of possessiveness. I am your servant. You are my beloved. You, Sriman Mahaprabhu, you are my Prananath, whatever. There is an I me mind there, but it's a real one, a sober one, a sustainable one in eternity, based on who we are. So there is possessiveness in divine love, there is possessiveness in conditioned life. So the emptying of false sense of possessiveness is not to do away with all possessiveness altogether at all, but just to get rid of the fall designations, of the fall roles that create fall identities and fall performances and false relationships. Many times, going to what you are saying, or you were asking, Sweta Radhika, about depending on others. Because if I relate to other people in terms of all these false values, anartha, right? So I derive my sense of I based on what I think it belongs to me, then I start to relate to people from that place. If I think, I don't know, the more money I have, to give an example, the more money I have, the more I am, then all my relationships will be affected by that filter, by that misunderstanding. And money will be always a consideration in how I relate to anyone. And whenever, because I'm deriving my identity from money, or I'm deriving my identity from possessiveness. So if possessiveness or money gets to be threatened at any point in any relationship, I will do away with the relationship, unfortunately, because money or possessiveness is giving me a sense of identity, and I cannot live without a sense of identity. We will go crazy, right? So, but that creates toxic codependence, because sometimes, okay, to get my money that gives me an identity, I remain in relationships that are toxic or abusive or whatever, so I can get my money or my, and I can get my possessions and I can get my identity. You follow my point? I cannot have possessions without money, people will think, and I need possessions to be someone. Unconsciously, we are not thinking this consciously, probably, but people may think, okay, I need an identity. I need something to be had that is mine to be someone. For that, I need money. To get money, I need to relate to people in this way and in that way. And you start to learn all the crookedness that is required for you to even get the most possible money from any possible relationship. And we know how that story ends. So that's why some people, and I will say many cases will be more people in orders of renounced orders, is like, I don't want to do anything with money. I have nothing to do with money. I don't have money, literally, like poverty, literally, no possessions, just begging, just depending. Again, I'm not saying everyone has to do that, but some people may be inspired to embrace this principle of poverty or of akinchana from that place. Some others may be more, okay, I have things. I take care of things following the idea of Yukta Vairagya, which is I'm not owning anything. I mean, things are under my care, in service. I relate to them, but they are not mine. I'm not putting my signature below, which is a Yukta Vairagya, practical renunciation. So those are like the general patterns that we are being given. Then how those take shape in any given case and relationship, that's different. Like you were asking about me, for example. So, how to say? I personally, I mean, as you can see, it's not that someone gives me one coin and I throw the coin back to them. Sometimes people give me donations. Okay, I receive the donation. Then I have a big trouble knowing what to do with that, to be honest. And many times I give that begging donation to someone else. To be honest, I don't have much problem with money. In that case, each one has their own Achilles heel. Sometimes it's a burden, but more in the sense of what to do with this, because it's an energy, right? It's Lakshmi Devi, right? Lakshmi Devi, we call money Lakshmi Devi. So that's in the service of Bhagavan. So it's a delicate thing. Okay, how to engage this energy properly? And sometimes when we may need to say no. For example, if someone wants to give something voluntarily, that's one thing. But I'm speaking for myself. Okay, someone comes to, okay, Maharaj, here, a donation. I'm like, I mean, first of all, if it comes from your heart, okay, I don't know what to do with that. I'll see. But don't do it even as a forced thing. I'm supposed I have to. I don't need that. And you won't be more in my eyes if you give me a donation or not, right? And on top of that, if you give me a donation, don't think that I'm owning you something because you gave me a donation. Because it happens a lot. Someone like, okay, gives you a donation, or then you owe me a favor. Then you never gave a donation. That was not a donation. Right? I know many stories of sadhus that, okay, some of the disciples will come with a, I don't know, with a bag, like a bag of, I don't know, $100,000. I don't know what that is, never received such an amount. And they will receive that from a disciple and they will open it, not even open, like, no, there is a donation, take the bag, put it somewhere else and continue the conversation. Like saying, right, okay, but even not saying thank you, and I know this may be even shocking for our culture, but remember some of the things that Srila Siddhamara say that if you give me money and I say thank you, it's a way of saying you are giving something to me. So I'm creating a duality. Like you are the giver, I'm the receiver. Well, actually, we are all in the same team. It's all the same pocket. So the donation you are giving is not for me. Like me as a as an isolated project. I will take this and I will enjoy it selfishly for my own private consumption. That's not supposed to be the spirit. So in that context, sometimes sadhus won't even say thank you, because that will reinforce a safe sense of separateness. What to speak of them feeling, oh, I owe you so much now because you have given me all this money. No way. A real sadhu cannot be balked, right? By money. So we should be careful also of how we deal in our relationship with that. I personally, that's why generally I basically do not charge for anything I do, because I know that's complicated. And I trust that whatever I may need, if I need to get a toothpaste or a soap, or I don't know, the clothes are dying, I need a new pair. Or somehow, some donation will come, something will come, and it always works. So that's fine. That's how it works for me. Again, I'm not saying everyone should do like that. You have to find your way. But it should be in a way that, again, you can be relatively, on some level, trusting also. You know, how you choose to live your life with integrity will bring whatever you need. Trying not to depend on others from a toxic place. Of course, there's a different thing as to the healthy support that we give each other in sadhu sangha and affection, and but that's very different from what I've been just talking about. With the dependence is calculated, is selfish, is like you owe me a favor and I give you this. And like I remember in Argentina some years ago, someone donated like a washing machine for the temple. And we need the washing machine. So they donated the washing machine. Okay, thank you. And then after like 6 years, the guy came to demand the washing machine back. And I was like, you've never given the washing machine then. And we gave the washing machine back, and he complained that it was used. It's like, well, I thought you gave the washing machine for us to use it, and it has been 6 years. So, yeah, we have been using the washing machine for 6 years. Please take it back and never bring anything back here. Because, but, and Krishna speaks about that in the Bhagavad Gita, right? When he speaks about charity, the charity that is given, how to say in English, begrudgingly. Like, I don't know if I'll give it or not. Even if it's given, but I don't what to speak of being given and then reclaim back and then trying to own the person, but what you've given, that's like you cannot even call that charity. That's something else. That's manipulation, that's whatever. So genuine charity should be given from a place of gratitude and joy, not calculating and trusting the natural order of things and not being calculated. If I'm given this, I will have less. At the same time, you have to apply discernment with your finances. That's another conversation. So, so I don't know. You ask for my thoughts. I went all around, Svetlana Radhika. Maybe I didn't answer anything concretely. You tell me.
Yeah, I mean, it's always helpful to hear, but I guess what I was looking more for, like a vulnerable dependency in terms of like emotional dependency, you know, like being dependent on each other. I mean, I'm sorry, actually, I think I didn't frame my question clear enough. Also, there was another part where she says that a real community cannot exist if people don't have a sense of dependency on each other. You know, like, so I was kind of trying to understand that, you know, like depending on each other, like, how does that really look?
Okay. Yeah, I'll say a little bit more. Okay, that helps to clarify the question. So I personally think there should be a balance, right? Because you can go to both extremes, like totally independent. We are not independent, right? Like by ontologically, the soul is not its own island, right? We do not exist in as isolation from everything else. We all exist in relationship, right? Which doesn't mean toxic codependency. No, it's very different to acknowledge we are all related. At the same time, I cannot become excessively dependent on other people for certain things, like the examples I was giving. Or I shouldn't compromise my identity, my integrity, sorry, in the name, in depending on others for whatever, ideally not. So community, again, we are all living in community in one way or another, whether we are living in the same plot of land or we are just the community of planet Earth, the community of reality. It's all community. Reality is communal by nature. So we can pay attention to how nature and reality operates, right? Yeah, there is an interdependence, maybe not codependence, but interdependence sounds a little bit more healthy psychologically. So we are having an impact on each other, but also I will say we have to develop some how to say capacity to not to be extremely isolated by our own in an arrogant way or anything. But also learn to be with ourselves. You know? Because I've seen many people, especially in community, spiritual community, I've seen people go into community just to escape from themselves. So they want to merge. It's a form of, I remember, what's his name? He wrote Unspoken Obstacles to the Path of Bhakti, On the Path to Bhakti. Recommended book. Kavi Chandra? Kavichandra? Anyhow, a Prabhupada disciple who wrote that book, and he speaks about very interesting things, one of them being impersonalism and different shades of impersonalism. And one of those being that, not necessarily saying I want to become one with Brahman, but just joining a group, Purna Chandra, thank you, Anuradha, Purna Chandra Swami. So, one of the ways of merging or sayujja is I merge into a group. And I stop thinking for myself, feeling for myself, confronting what I need to confront, integrating what I need to integrate, and just become one and nothing, one nothing in the crowd. Just following whatever everyone says, whatever. So that's impersonalism. So all this in the context of community and the idea of depending on one another. Yeah, there is a mutual supporting community. We are counting on one another, we are helping one another, but I have to do my part also. And I have to be my own self. Again, not isolated, but I cannot become overtly depending on everyone. Sometimes in life, I may need to be by myself. Like the Bhagavatam will say, sometimes you have to be your own guru. Right? Like implying you may not have your guru or a sadhu or someone next to you to provide wise advice. You have to be able to do that to yourself. So you have to be, how to say in English, self-reliant. Again, not in a toxically independent way. Like I don't need anyone. Nobody can help in anything. I can do it all by myself in a very egoic, self-centered way. But not to the other extreme again of just toxic codependency, where you merge into the community and you expect the community to do your part, the community to save you, whatever. right? To provide what you need the most without you going through your own process of self-knowledge. Community is there to support our own individual journey, but the journey on one level remains individual. It's communal at the same time. It's bit a bit. It's both at the same time. It's not one or the other. It's not like community or individuality. The two are at the same time. So I'm saying all this because, yeah, I've lived in literally in community ashrams for 2 decades, and you see all those patterns in others and also in oneself. So trying to find a sweet spot and middle balance. Yeah, we can be vulnerable. We can share with each other. We can count on each other. Even if you want to use the word, we can depend on each other. But the point is sometimes you were depending on someone, and that someone failed. So how you continue? You have to be able to continue. So if you are overtly depending on that person to the point of losing your own self-reliance, your life is over when that person fails and is no longer there. So that's not healthy. So community shouldn't be fostering that type of codependency. Because let's be honest, communities are not like, of course, eternal community, Golok Vrindavan, that's another reality. No, there will be no blooped members in the community there. Nobody falls from Vaikuntha, okay? There's no blooped people in the spiritual world. Another conversation. But the point is here, sometimes you may be sharing a community space with people, but some people may be there, may leave the community eventually, or may not, depending each case, but some of them may leave, may return, may be more participatory, less, more present, because they are going through their own individual journey also. So we cannot be overtly reliant on having that person playing that role always for, I mean, I would like to, like I was personally with the idea, yeah, I mean, be accepting this particular spiritual master at one point in my journey, I'm expecting, yeah, I will continue relating to this person the rest of my life and for eternity. That didn't happen. So you have to recalculate. I cannot just kill myself or blame the other person and because of you, now my life is miserable and I don't know what to do with my life. So it's all your fault. No. I need to continue. Huh? So that will be for me a sober way. Again, we love community, we want community, we may have the we want to embrace a romantic ideal of community. I do, I portray in my mind an ideal version, as I spoke many times of it, to that me village. Whether that happens or not, I don't know. And if it happens, I may have an idea of how an ideal unfolding of that should be, but generally that will never be the case in practice. And it may end up in nothing, or it may never, so many things could happen. And I cannot, my point is, my life cannot depend on any of those possibilities because all of those possibilities may happen, none of those possibilities may happen, some of those possibilities may happen. And I cannot be just clinging on what it happens for me to be happy or not happy on a daily basis. I need to gain some individual personal foundation that becomes, in the good sense of the term, invulnerable. I hope you get my point, to these back ups and downs or potential changes. And it doesn't mean that if I'm in community, I'm mistrusting and thinking at any moment this is over, and you're counting on the days and you're waiting for every relationship to end and you become a cynic and a fatalistic. No, you invest yourself, you participate. There is a risk. There is a risk in love. Every time you choose love, every time you choose a relationship, there is a risk involved because nobody's giving you a warranty. This will last forever. There will be no problem. The other one will not fail. You will not fail. Again, never and always. Who can say that? So there's some risk involved always, but we cannot live without it. So we have to have a proper foundation in ourselves. So every time we are signing in for a new risk love project, We can do it with enough foundation that we are jumping into it fully with intention. And if unfortunately that doesn't work, still I have my foundation of self-reliance not to go crazy and not to go cynic and miss and not try it again in time. But so, and I'm not saying it's easy. I never use the word easy here, but it's way easier to work on that as an individual and to gain those resources than to having to confront a situation where the things I was depending on collapse and I did not have those resources. That's difficult, to say the least. So, and again, not to say be prepared for tragedy, but so many things can happen at any moment. So we better are working on ourselves so we can deal with reality from the most grounded place possible. With a robust sense of self-esteem and self-love, and Krishna is loving me, and I have that foundation, and individuals may fail, communities may fail, but still I know that certain principles in which through which reality operate never fail. But I have to have some relatively strong rootedness in that. No? Or you get rooted or you get rotten, to make a play of words. And we'll have circumstances in life that will come to show us where we are and what we need to further cultivate. There are so many degrees of all this, right? So yeah, community is beautiful. I mean, please don't take any of my words as anti-community. On the contrary, they are just for the sake of participating in a community project from a realistic place, not coming with over-idyllic expectations that then when we are not met, we become easily discouraged, easily lost, or trying to join a community for the wrong intentions. Our notion of community should be, yeah, sustainable, realistic. I hope now I responded in a little bit more clear way than before your
Yeah.
clarification.
Yes, Maharaj, very much. But although it sounds very, very difficult.
But not impossible.
Yes. Well, thank you so much.
I mean, you just analyze your relationship with any other individual, and probably you will label that as very, very difficult. So yeah, and it's not that the other is the difficult. It's okay, why it's very difficult not to chastise ourselves, but okay, why this is difficult to me? For some other person, maybe very difficult. For other, very, very difficult. For other, almost impossible. For other, well, relatively challenging but doable. So whatever we have to accept where we are and work from that moment on. Yeah. Okay, I think now we all deserve a breakthrough room, a break and a breakthrough room, including myself. So you're invited for a few minutes. Bhaktirasa will be opening the spaces now. And see you in a few moments. Welcome back. Hope you had a good meeting, private meeting. And we'll continue. There are two more raised hands today, one from Sherry, the other from Rasangi. So, Sherry, please, invited to unmute yourself. Welcome.
Hi, Bull. Pranams, everyone. Really good to be here. Thank you, Maharaj, for answering all of our questions. I really have been absorbing so much from today's session. And I guess my question is, I was recently listening to your it's on YouTube, the process pop-up. I guess it was about 2 weeks ago you were doing. And during the question section, a question came up about Jesus, asking if he is an avatar. And you had sort of mentioned that he's considered a Shakti Avesh avatar. I don't know if I said that right. But that there that, that you know, it would take too much time to go into the different breaking down the different types of avatar as far as that goes. So I guess I was just curious to learn more about Jesus and what kind of avatar, what the Shakti Avesh avatar is considered. I know from what I understand, Jesus was always sort of considered, you know, like a teacher, a guru, like very well regarded. But I have had similar questions, like, is he considered an avatar, and in what way?
Thank you. So yeah, there are different, let's go word by word and define words. What do we mean by avatar? Because sometimes, and this is a whole thing about especially with words from another language, but even with words from our own language that we use them, and for us they mean generally only one thing, right? If I say anything, generally means something in particular and not more than that. In my own language, what to speak if I go to a Sanskrit term. So avatar, sometimes we may even translate it as incarnation or something, though it's not very accurate translation. It's more kind of a way of saying divine descent. Now, again, there are many avatars described in scripture: Purusha avatar, Guna avatar, Yuga avatar, Shakti Avesha avatar, and among Shakti Avesha avatar, subcategories: Jnana Avesh avatar, Bhakti Avesh avatar. I don't want to, super complicate the whole thing today for you. Those interested in the obsession that Indian theologians have with categories, you can let me know and I can share this exact references. But it seems that somehow Indian thought in general is quite leaning on categorizing and subcategorizing and sub-sub-subcategorizing things. So you have all this, like, which is interesting, it's beautiful. It's a way of like of fleshing out things, but also it could be a little overwhelming. So it's how to deal with all that without getting lost in a sea of sub 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 divisions of everything. So again, avatar means divine descent. Avatara, crossing from up to down, basically that's the meaning. So it generally refers to a particular expression of the divine appearing in this world in a particular way, because of course, in principle, we could say God is omnipresent, right? So we have to know how to deal with the notion of avatar in a way that doesn't make God utterly or exclusively transcendent and not immanent. So only when he comes as an avatar, God comes. When the avatar is not here, God is not here. Sorry, guys. You are left in a pool of non-divinity in this world. No, that's not correct. No? And that's why we need all these categories sometimes. We need to speak about, okay, Advaita Gyan Tattva, like the Vatan say, Tattvam Yak Jnanam Advayam Brahmeti Paramatmeti Bhagavan Iti Shabdyate. The Absolute is Brahman, Bhagavan, Paramatma, all these. And all these are different facets of the same Absolute. And they speak about omnipresence, all pervadingness, impersonal dimensions, personal dimensions. So avatar speaks about a particular personal descent of the Absolute, at least in general. There are many categories. But in one way or another, interacting with material creation, let's put it that way. We don't hear about avatars in Golok Vrindavan, right? Because, again, divine descent, the avatars come from there to here, if we have to speak in terms of there and here, like up and down. Again, it's not about the geography as we think it that way, but the dimensions of consciousness. So a Shakti Avesha avatar doesn't necessarily mean that that person is God, literally. Or we will say does not belong to the category of Vishnu Tattva. It can be a soul, Jiva Tattva, like we are. But it's a soul, Shakti Avesha. Shakti means potency. And Avesh means like invested with. So Shakti Aveshavatar means there is a particular soul. I mean, you could be one of those. Srila Prabhupada has been named as a Shakti Aveshavatar, and I don't want to sound like I'm putting all of you casually at the same level of Prabhupada, but I'm just saying it's not just Jesus or Prabhupada. It could be a particular descent of a divine potency through one particular living entity. And through that descent, unique descent, something very extraordinary happens that is quite undeniable for most people. Like it's like, wow, this is not ordinary. Something is going on here, right? Yes, that's what we call Shakti Aveshavatar, the descent avatar of a particular Shakti, in relation to a soul that becomes Avesh, that becomes imbued with that particular descent and embodies that through their life and teachings and so on. So that's basically what's a Shakti Aveshavatar. So in the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, traditionally, Jesus has been conceived as such with that terminology. Prabhupada, Srila Siddhar Maharaj, and others have referred to him as that, which again, they are not putting Jesus in the God category, so to say. But referring to him as what will be more in line with the principle of guru or teacher or pure devotee, enlightened sage, prophet, however we may like to use that word, and a pure, transparent, surrender vessel through which the divine energy flows unimpeded. So again, it's not limited to Jesus. It can be with many other people. And I know many Christians who will say things like that. No? Like I remember we did this podcast with Charlene Kendrick, and I remember you watched that one, Sherry. You made that clear to me. And at one point I remember she said, Jesus is not example to us. Jesus is an example of us. No? Which is very much in line to how Srila Siddhar Maharaj will describe what guru is. It's your own potential appearing in front of you. So guru is an example of you. Not to say I'm there, but it's a mirror of potential, basically. A guru is mirror of potential. They're reflecting back all that you can be. You may not be there yet, but you are having a glimpse about your brightest prospect. So Jesus similarly seen in that light. In one sense, of course, you cannot deny them as divine beings, and in our tradition, we will even find things of Sakshat Haridvena Samastra Shastra, right? Uktastadhavabhyatayivasatbhihi Kintu Prabhurjapriyaivatasyam Mande Guru Sri Charanaravindam. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur sings Sakshat Haridvena Samastra Shastra. Guru is to be considered as non as directly Hari. It's non-different from God. So that sounds like wow. Then the guru is not a jiva, then the guru is God. But then he said, Kintu, Prabhurya Priyayavatasya, but the guru is the dearest of God. So then comes the paradox of Bhedavid. Is God or is not God? In which sense is God the guru or the teacher? In a representational sense. Again, as Prabhupada will say, transparent be a medium. Someone through whom the divine presence is become very clear, very evident, very palpable, very tangible, very transformative. In that sense, he's God. In that sense, he or she, just in case. But at the same time, guru is an individual, a soul, like each one of us. Again, having actualized its potential to a considerable degree. So he or she can become a mirror of potential for others. So guru is God and is not God in that sense. And the same way we could say Jesus is God and is not God. Like someone asked Srila Siddhar Maharaj once, so guru is Vishnu Tattva, like pertaining to the category of God, or guru is Jiva Tattva, pertaining to the category of soul? Guru is Vishnu Tattva or Jiva Tattva, and Srila Siddhar Maharaj say Guru is Guru Tattva. Right? It's its own category, which somehow includes the other two in their own unique ways. So it's all nuance. It's not like black and white. Again, we the more we grow, the more we will leave black and white thinking, or the more we will realize there are endless shades of both black and white. What to speak of all the other colors in between. So yeah, we can think of Jesus in that way. Jesus himself presented himself in that way. He prayed to the Father constantly. Of course, he said, "I am the Father, I'm one, we are one." But again, what do we mean by one? Yeah, we and God are one. We are inseparable from our source. Me and Krishna are one. It doesn't mean in every sense of the word, I am Krishna talking to you now on Zoom, to all of you. But we are not entirely different either. So we are not entirely one. Entirely. We are not, that will be Advaita, Shankaracharya's Advaita Vedanta, entirely one, only Brahman. But we are not entirely different either. That will present an ontological dualism. Like in the core root, reality is divided, which is a problem. It has its own problems. So, bit of it, one and different. So that's how we will see Jesus. That's how we could even justify how we see Jesus based on what Jesus himself said. He will himself say, talking to his own disciples, "You will be doing things greater than I did." That's a very interesting statement he did, which is very much in the spirit of this idea. If we see Jesus as Sadhu, Guru Tattva has to do with parampara also, to the ongoing transmission of not only knowledge, but a living reality. So the nature of a transmission of something living is that the thing will become more and more living as it's passed by, more and more deep, more and more broad. So no wonder Jesus will say, "Okay, I'm giving you this, and I'm doing this in relation, but you will be able to do something greater." That's the ever-evolving nature of a living tradition. So it's the same. Our acharyas from the past did something great, incredible, beautiful, as best as they could at that time, so to say. But that doesn't mean that we should just do the same or less. Actually, we are invited to do, give, say more. Not because we are better than them. By their grace and by the ever-evolving nature of the substance that is being trespassed in parampara. So Jesus had that dynamic spirit. You will be doing greater things than I did. It doesn't mean that we're insulting what he did. It's just he's speaking about the nature of reality. It keeps getting greater. It's getting better all the time. There's a song saying that. So yeah, that's how we will view Jesus, Shaktiabhis avatar. And again, inside Shaktiabhis avatar, there are specific subdivisions. For example, in connection to Srila Prabhupada, it's interesting because nowadays it's of common understanding that people will speak about Prabhupada as a Shakti Avesh avatar. In the society he founded, ISKCON, but the first person that framed Prabhupada as such was Srila Siddhar Maharaj. But generally, yeah, that's not so acknowledged, or people do not even know. And he did not even say that Prabhupada was a Shakti Avesh avatar, but when he said that, Bhaktisundar Govinda Maharaj asked him, "And which type of avesh?" Because you can say Shakti Avesh avatar is a soul invested, you say in English, with the potency of God. But there are many potencies of God. So that's why we have many subdivisions of Shakti Avesh avatars. You can be invested with the Bhakti Shakti, like Narad Muni, with the Jnana Shakti, like Vyasadeva, to compile scripture, and so on. So Srila Govinda Maharaj says, Srila Siddhar Maharaj, "So Srila Swami Maharaj, Srila Prabhupada is a Shakti Avesh avatar. So which type of avesh, which type of empowerment he was receiving, from which particular energetic department, right? Or for which phase of the divine?" And Srila Siddhar Maharaj will say, "Nityananda avesh, Nityananda avesh." So he created a new subcategory. I don't think anyone ever before that said someone can be Nityananda Besh as a Shakti Vesh avatar. So it keeps evolving, no? The very realization. Because his campaign, Prabhupada's campaign, resembled very much Nityananda Prabhu's campaign, which was how, by the way, the whole Gaudiya Sampradaya began. They were the original Nityananda Prabhu and his group, his band of transcendental bandits, his gang, the Dwadasa Gopals in Brajalila, accompanying him in Gaur Lila's 12 people. They began the Gaudiya Sampradaya before their Goswamis wrote books, before the whole theology was systematized. They just were dancing and rolling on the ground and crying and singing and knocking on doors. People will open and they were like embracing them and rolling on, and they were, that how's the epidemic started. And especially they went, especially in Nityananda Prabhu, he will go to the least favored sections of society. He wouldn't go to the powerful and the influential. He will go to the most, the outcasts. So very much in line with Jesus, right? In that way also. I go into the less privileged, to the sick, to the poor, to the outcast, and hanging around with them and making them his tribe, so to say. So that's how the Gaudiya Vaishnava movement started. What it has become in time, in some cases, that's something different. Because people always get enamored by power, privilege, prestige. That's part of human psychology and weakness. But we should never forget our roots. So in that sense, Prabhupada, the same way he went to the US, he was in that particular section in New York, which I've been there a few times. That's not the most privileged section of the country, let's put it that way. No? The Lower East Side and Tompkins Square Park, as I said many times, I went there, and there are homeless people living there from that time. And even some people came to me that were there by the time Prabhupada was in Tompkins Square Park, and they remain living as homeless people now in their 70s, and they will tell me, "I know I saw your Prabhupada here and at that time," these type of things, right? So his campaign resembled very much, again, speaking about poverty, you know, before he came with nothing, went to the less privileged. He came without privilege, basically, without it. Support and not knowing everyone and having all the money. So very much resembling the mood of Nityananda Prabhu's campaign. So with those things in mind, that shows how much Srila Siddhar Maharaj was knew who Prabhupada was and knew not only who was he was in India, but what he was doing outside of India. So much that he could relate all those things to Nityananda Prabhu's campaign and then say, I can see how he's the inspiration he's receiving is coming from Nityananda Prabhu. And we are here all a byproduct of that, right? So I don't know if that helps, Sherry, about Jesus, Shakti Abhis Avatar, Nityananda
Yeah,
Prabhupada.
that helps me to sort it a bit. Sometimes it's hard for me to keep track of it all as I'm
Laila?
learning.
And I tried to
And
make it simple, sorry.
yeah, thank you. It's easy to get caught up in the weeds sometimes. And yeah, I also often think a lot about Chaitanya and Christ and kind of a lot of comparisons. And that's for another time, you
Yeah.
know. And I think, you know, I have to keep filtering it all through, you know, the Christianity I was raised with, because Jesus is so important to me. It's like I'm embracing Gaudiya, then that's what I want, because that's what brings my heart into the most dwelling place, I feel like. But at the same time, I feel like I have to keep filtering it through my Christian background, and it's an interesting process. Thank you.
Thank you. And of course, there is a place for this cross-pollination and finding connections and parallels, even beyond these two traditions. Of course, every genuine embodiment of truth will show these things. At the same time, I will say we have to be careful not to absolutely filter everything through our previous lenses, because not necessarily everything we'll find a parallel, everything will be the same. Like, okay, Jesus and Mahaprabhu and Chaitanya. Yeah, there are many parallels, but Jesus is not Krishna trying to taste Radha Bhav. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. I
We cannot make that ontological coincidence. So I'm not saying it's better or worse. I'm just saying no need to push it to that point. But I will say there are enough commonalities on certain level for us to draw those commonalities and be at awe in that and find like charm and beauty and say, wow, how incredible this natural pattern of how this unfolds in this tradition, through this prophet, through this face of God. Then when you go into more details, okay, there may be some differences, but we go to the differences having established a clear foundation of oneness in certain foundational things, which doesn't mean that everything is the same, which doesn't mean that everything is different either. So again, bit a bit. We have to always be navigating this creative tension of unity and diversity, unity and diversity. And yeah, at the end of the day, it all boils down to the basic non-sectarian claim that any genuine mystical tradition, say in our tradition, will say, ikamsat bipram bahudha abhidhanti, right? Truth is one, and sages speak of it differently. No? So there's one God, truth one divine. I mean, just basic, right? 101, as they will say, 101 non-sectarian spirituality. Truth is one, different sages, personality, saints will use different words, approaches, but we are all talking about the same truth. So there's unity, but there's diversity, and there's unity.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Maharaj.
Thank you. Okay, one more breakthrough room. I mean, not one more, two more. This, and then we'll go to Rasangi, and then we'll have the last one before we conclude. So for a few minutes, let's go churn a little bit further, whatever comes through you, regards to Jesus, Prabhupada, Nityananda, Shaktivedanta, Avatar, Guru, Mirror of Potential. More than invited to join. See you in a few minutes. Okay, welcome back. One more time. Hoping you had a abundant meal together of nourishing the hearts, and we'll conclude today's meeting with Rasangi from California, invited to unmute herself. Welcome.
Hello, hello. First, this is for Sam. This is Chanakya Pandit. He doesn't look very happy. He looks very angry. This is from Wikipedia. Hey, Sam, look. Woo!
We, if Wikipedia say so.
I know, right? There's, ooh. Anyway, Maharaj, what I have to offer today is it's an offering. It's a journaling entry by Krishna Kumari from our reading group, Maharaj. And it was response to the eighth pause in the first chapter. And we all loved it so much that some of the ladies thought we should read this today so everyone can feel inspired and that you can see how much we're doing holy shifts. We're making holy shifts. We are. As a result of our study, I must say. Okay. So, and she's shy. She would be too scared to read it, too shy. So she asked us if we can read it. We asked her and she said yes. So she's saying, I did a journaling exercise where I wrote to Radha and Krishna to interact with them around imagining sacred divine love having a tangible form and interaction with me on a personal level. And this is what came. Dear Krishna Kumari, I have never been disappointed in your longing. The ache you feel is not a flaw. It is evidence of your capacity for intimacy. You learned to be strong because you had to be. But strength was never the core of you. Love is. I do not need you to endure more to earn me. I do not need you to stay where your spirit is shrinking to prove devotion. I am not honored by your self-abandonment. I'm revealed in your honesty. When your chest tightens, that is not rebellion against me. It's your inner wisdom asking for alignment. You are allowed to grow beyond roles that once defined you. You are allowed to choose life. You are allowed to want joy. Your anger is a distorted form of protection. Let me hold the protection for a while. You do not have to collapse in order to be loved. You do not have to disappear in order to stay connected. I am not fragile. Your truth does not threaten me. Wow. Walk toward what makes your soul breathe. I will meet you there, not as a judge, but as a companion. And we will discover together what your love was always meant to become.
Amen. And ki jai to Krishna Kumari. Yeah.
We all
Thank
loved
you.
it so much, Mars. We wanted to share it with you and everyone else. It was so touching for all of us who've heard it from her. And yeah, I mean, the
Yeah.
shifts are happening. You know what I mean? We all spent time, we're reflecting on the paradigm shifts. We're not rushing through this. We're kind of taking time and sharing, which has really been very fruitful, I think, for all of us. So thank you again.
Thank you.
That's it.
So that's it, right? Rasangi, just for me to confirm, because just, I mean, not like that's it, like that's it. No.
That's it. I mean,
Just to
it's
confirm,
like
there was nothing else coming, but that's a full plate into itself.
it is, you know, the fact that we can grow, that it's working, that whatever we're doing here is really working to help us grow and shift and have different angles of vision. It's quite miraculous. Just
And from
saying.
what I was thinking when you were reading it, of course she's and I'm in touch with Krishna Kumari. We have ongoing interactions, so I've had the fortune of through written exchanges to witness her blossoming throughout the years. And that's of course in itself miracle into itself to witness anyone else's blossoming. But yeah, I was thinking, of course, the letter is kind of Radha and Krishna talking to her, but in that talking and it perfectly embodies their voice. Of course, I'm not saying that's just her writing about them. Now that's very much reflecting how they actually speak. But at the same time, of course, that's speaking about her. No, though the letter is them speaking to her, that speaks about her as much as it is them speaking to her, speaking about her approach to them and her transformed. Again, I don't want to sound this center on Krishna Kumari, but it's speaking about the journey of transformation for any one of us, and how if we will have to write that same letter 10 years ago, probably we will have put words into the poor mouths of Radha and Krishna, words that, oh my gosh, you know, they will have never said that to us, but according to our own filter and view of them, we will have made them say things that were not coherent, basically. So for me, what you just shared and what Krishna Kumari wrote, of course, feels like a way more very coherent. How to say, a very coherent way for Radha and Krishna to talk to us, and a very coherent way for us to understand how they are talking to us, and it's a way of her sharing her own testimony and life journey, right? Like sometimes you have these circles of people that get together and they share their testimony because that's powerful, right? You can You can write books and share concepts but when it comes embodied in a particular life journey, concrete person that you know exists. Well, to speak that it's friends of you and you see and you're witnessing that like transformation. So that becomes way more concrete, we're more tangible and we're more undeniable. And it's so impactful. So even if she's not talking in this letter, I, Krishna Kumari, have undergone this transformation. She's saying all that by the way she's making Radha and Krishna speak to her, so to say. So that's beautiful. And in the same way, sometimes you can see, unfortunately, how other people, by the way they make God speak to them, you can see how much of a distorted idea they have about the divine. Because they think God is this, God is that. If I do not do this, well, this the exact opposite to what Krishna Kumari said, basically. So for me, yeah, it's a powerful, humbling testimony of healing, of healing, of redemption, empowerment, rediscovery, and all that keeps the whole life and process all attractive, right? And the divine all attractive. We shouldn't rest until we find each aspect of all of this really attractive. Again, Krishna is the all attractive. And he janmadi asya jata. I mean, I'm sorry, but I cannot avoid giving a trailer of what we'll be talking this Monday in the Bhagavatam course. But the very first words of the Bhagavatam are janmadi asya jata, which means Krishna is that person from which everything else emanates. So if Krishna is all attractive, whatever emanates from Krishna is all attractive somehow. So I have to, but I have to gain the proper view to find all the things attractive that exist in a natural connection with Krishna. So yeah, I'm happy to. We are all happy. Hopefully I'm talking for all of you to be able to witness a journey of transformation. And I know that that's of course not limited to Krishna Kumari. So in that sense, I said, I don't want to center it on her, not to dismiss her, but not to exclude each one of you whom I know. And I know that you could be writing your own love letters from God, as Daniel Ladinsky will title his poetry book, right? Love letters from God. And you could write your own letter and feel free to do so. In many very similar ways, right? Of rediscovering a very redeeming and healing and healthy and attractive representation of the divine and the reality, and one that really it's inviting to participate. And then the rest is answering the question how to participate today, tomorrow, at every moment. That's the only question that remains. Not whether God likes me or not, whether love loves me or not, like with the petals of a flower. Does he love me? He loved me not. Will he send me to hell or not? When you have healed all those layers, you realize those questions actually never existed. So what's the real question, right? How to return the embrace to the actual divinity, which is all attractive. So thank you. And send our gratitude, our collective gratitude to Krishna Kumari for agreeing to, for you to share that and for you probably to have put some loving pressure on her to share that with us. So yeah, it's all part of the same equation. And let's conclude our meeting with a breakup drum
One
reflecting
thing,
together.
Maharaj. One
Yes.
thing, Rick. I remember reading in Krishna book somewhere, like when someone gets to serve, everyone's very happy for them. Like we can be happy. We have to be happy for each other in our advancement, our growth, and our shifting. And that feels so lovely. Like we're
Yeah.
not envious. We
Yeah. That's.
rejoice in each other's holy
Yeah.
shifts and changes, right?
Yeah, because if someone is transformed, that's a blessing for the rest of the world. So we are being blessed, not to keep it selfish. But if someone is blessed, it's not just their own benefit, so to say. That's a benefit for everyone. So there are always reasons to celebrate. And Yeah, that's what's highlighted in the Zenith of the Bhagavatam. Sorry to go to the Bhagavatam again. I shouldn't say sorry. I mean, we have to go there over and over again. But Rasa Lila, the Zenith of the Bhagavatam, all the gopis are singing together, dancing together, all loving Krishna. And there's no like envy. And when Krishna disappears, and the with Radha, and the gopis find Radha abandoned by Krishna, so to say, they do not feel happy or celebrate, but they join her. With empathy and compassion, they start to sing together and celebrate together again, satsanga. And then Krishna returns and they're all celebrating. So that's kind of a template going back to the ideal of community, right? Each of us our own individual, but like the Napoleon chair, like Srila Sivamurthy Maharaj will say, like everyone seated on someone, offering oneself a seat to someone, giving support, offering support, individuating ourselves. No need for envy. That's the beginning of the Bhagavatam. And Dharma Prito Kaito Tra Paramonirmat Saranam Satam. This book will be understood by those who are devoid of envy, like implying this book is not about envy. So it's not that if you have some envy, you don't get it, but as much as you got envy, you won't get what the book is about. Because it's about how we don't need that stuff, right? So when we witness cases like you, like the one you share, Krishna Kumar, it's like, oh yeah, there's no need to be envious. There's no need to see her testimony as a competition or as a threat, but it's a gift to the collective, right? A gift to the tribe, and we all celebrate together. So let's go on celebration to the break of the room for a few minutes to share your own insights regarding the beautiful words that we just heard from this life testimony, maybe about your own life testimony, and we will meet in a few minutes to say goodbye to put this discussion to rest. Hey, welcome back. Hoping you had a good sharing. And we'll put to rest our gathering today. Looking forward to meet each other again next weekend, maximum for our satsang on Saturday, but of course, for those who have time, willingness, we are inviting you and reminding you that the day after tomorrow, Monday, we are starting a new series, the weekly series on the study of the Srimad Bhagavatam, the living heart of the Bhagavatam, a journey into its essential message. So we are all more than invited to participate. It will be the same link. And one important point is that it will be at 2 p.m. EDT time, because they are doing time-like saving in the US starting tomorrow. So till today is EST time, but starting from Monday is EDT time. So for those living outside of the US, that may change 1 hour your timing. I've made a post today announcing that. If you don't like it, speak with the US government that they are the ones who organize that stuff. In Argentina, they don't change daylight savings, so you have to see that yourself. But just for you to know, so you don't miss, you don't connect an hour later, and then you realize, oh, it's almost gone. So just for you to adjust accordingly, hopefully. And if not, we'll be uploading the sharings in my YouTube channel. No problem. Okay. Srimad Mahaprabhu ki jai, Harinam Sankirtan ki jai, Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Sadhu Sangha ki jai, Gaur Premananda Hari Bol, Vanchakalpatarubhyascha Kripasindubhyaiva cha, Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namah.